Well, yes, it's a great honor for me to get this award, and I have to thank everybody from the Academy and my mother and father. But actually, it's a particularly touching to be getting the Carl Rogers Award, because he's the person whose life and whose work has provided just about all the theoretical foundation for my own work. And the friendship and love between us remains one of the blessings of my life. So thank you very much for the Carl Rogers Award. So after a very detailed and theoretical afternoon, where we've gone into the micro level of that psychological process, I sort of want to blow it all up and go up to the 35,000 foot level, maybe even the 65,000 foot level, but at the same time maybe ground it down into the lives that ordinary people are living on planet Earth right now. Carl Rogers was always interested in the big picture. He was interested in the long-term future of humanity, and he was interested in the long-term future of the planet. He saw that the world was changing radically and believed that humanistic psychology should and could make a positive contribution to that. In his last years, he turned his attention to the issues of peace and social justice, and the day he died, his family received notice that he'd been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. These brief remarks today, then, are intended as a tribute to the scope of my dear friend Carl's vision. Let me start out with the assertion that the world, as an interconnected whole, the geosphere, the biosphere, and most importantly for us as psychologists, I think, the psychosphere, is undergoing perhaps the most profound transformation since the development of life. The ingenuity of our species has had such an impact that human activity is now the principal force shaping the future of all the systems on the planet, ushering in what some people are now calling a new era, the Anthropocene era, which essentially means it's in our hands. So if this is true, and I think it is, I think the question we have to ask is, are we up to this task? Are we up to this level of responsibility of taking care of the whole of the planet and its future? Now, we know from cultural psychologists like Richard Sweda that in order for a community to remain stable and coherent, and its people live relatively free from deliberating anxiety, they must share a set of narratives, social constructions, patterns of consciousness and of embodied life, which for shorthand I'm calling the psychosphere. And this has to successfully account for all the challenges of existence. We heard this afternoon about the way in which the details of people's inner life is constructed socially within the context in which they live, but it's also maintained in terms of its coherence and its stability in those same contexts. So whether from the Bible, the Quran, myths sung by village griots, or conceptual paradigms taught in graduate schools, the psychospheres we inhabit sustain our identities, and at a very deep level, order and structure our experience. They provide the imaginal, conceptual, and behavioral frameworks that define what is real and give meaning and direction to our lives. They provide the basis for moral consensus that orders social relations so that people can live in peace, and they can provide the conceptual frameworks that frame our technologies and what we strive for. Living inside these narratives, people feel at home, they know where they stand, and life mostly makes sense. But when these narratives are ruptured or threatened, and they lose their psychological to explain things, people feel disoriented, and cultural consensus unravels. To be dislodged from one's place in things, whether a relationship, a job, a country, a neighborhood, to suffer injustice, to have one's trust betrayed, or one's identity violated, or to be deprived of one's familiar world as a refugee or an exile, which in our turbulent world is the experience of many millions all the time. are among the most disruptive psychological experiences human beings can suffer, and recovery may take generations. And as any clinician knows, it can drive any one of us to explosive violence, to despair, or to self-destructive collapse. Even when one chooses the disruption, like when we emigrate or relocate or take another job or voluntarily move into some new activity, the shock to the sense of self is still disorienting and it's still bewildering. To find oneself outside the psychosphere that has given life its coherence creates an existential crisis that has far-reaching psychological consequences. So what does it mean for us as psychologists and citizens of the early 21st century to realize that virtually all the people in every community on earth are now living through just that kind of disintegration of their local psychospheres? As our worlds change faster than we can keep up with, we're all experiencing the most rapid, widespread, and destabilizing disruptions of cultural coherence that our species has probably ever encountered. Now, I won't enumerate all the forces that are driving this upheaval. I've written about them before, and so have many others. But I believe it is becoming clear that the cumulative effects of the disruptions that has been to create a widening dissonance between the psyches inherited from our parents and grandparents and the worlds that must be navigated by them. An era of radical global dislocation and incoherence is upon us, and we have no idea how to address the psychological fallout from this process. The signs of the psychological crisis are not hard to find, but in the interest of time, I will just put them on the slides behind me as I talk. I submit that we are maybe approaching a cultural tipping point, and where we go from here might be dependent on what we choose to do as a society in response to this global crisis. The most common strategies individuals use for coping with this kind of crisis are the defensive routines familiar to psychologists, such as denial, blaming the victims, reaction formation, premature closure, addictions and compulsions, that serve to impose one's own forms of order on the chaos, however inadequate or neurotic this may seem. On the societal level, scapegoating, demonization, restrictions of civil liberties, border fences, pogroms, spin, bureaucratic paralysis, and gridlock all reflect in some way attempts to reassert power and to contain the potentially overwhelming anxiety. But as we know, these attempts at control often only make things worse. See what is going on in Iraq. And ultimately fail to keep the world in order and the anxiety manageable. And when they do fail, the alternatives are often far more destructive. Teenagers turn themselves into bombs, construct insane fantasies of massacre and mayhem, and then carry them out. Extreme forms of social pathology in the form of ethnic conflict, racial conflict, holy wars, crime, urban warfare, Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, corruption and violence, the list is endless. But this is only part of the story. As psychologists, we're aware that these are not the only responses to extreme psychological crisis. Anyone who's ever accompanied an individual through the journey through hell that accompanies catastrophic loss, the dissolution of identity and breakdown of psychological coherence knows that under the right circumstances, crises can result in extraordinary transformations. Therapists know that sometimes, after the fight for control has been abandoned and we accept the changed realities, a new way of understanding may be possible, a new level of integration achieved. The right circumstances often include a new sense of justice, compassion, and love. So if my analysis that the world is going through a global psychological crisis is correct, I propose that we consider that our profession, which touches the deeper experience of people in so many diverse arenas, might have a crucial role to play in how these global processes play out. What if we as professionals began to think of our work in this larger frame? What if instead of collaborating with the regressive forces of social reaction, we use our expertise to bear compassionate witness to humanity's devastating loss of coherence, its passage through what the Buddhists call the Bardo, and offer our skills to aid our collective journey to the next stage of our evolution? I think that when our humanistic ancestors, Rogers, Maslow, May, Moustakas, Watts, and their colleagues created the humanistic story in psychology more than 40 years ago, it was this larger social context, this larger historical moment that they had in mind. I'm not alone in believing that we're witnessing the emergence of a new global human community with sustaining narratives that are at once local and global in their scope. From the shards of a multitude of dissolving worlds, combined with new possibilities for creativity and connection offered through our astounding technology, science, and communications, and media, a new psychosphere is slowly being pieced together. And if we look closely at the vision of human beings that's reflected in this new story, though admittedly signs of both neurotic and psychotic reactions can be readily found, we might recognize a resonance with many of the ideas found in humanistic psychology. The story reflects a Western Enlightenment ideal of individual agency, responsibility, growth, and empowerment that is at the heart of the humanistic vision. But at the same time, it embraces and integrates the themes and idioms of older indigenous stories of community, relationship, embodiedness, and spirituality. And all of this is wrapped up in an entirely new story about our astonishing technical wizardry, interdependence, connectivity, and environmental fragility. And through the use of highly accessible telecommunications, these emerging stories are being exchanged, morphed, and amplified among people from every sector. I have time for just two stories here that I think illustrate something of what I'm talking about. One Scottish woman we met in a project for the International Futures Forum, who considered herself when the project started as a nobody. With the help of a person-centered social worker, organized a support group for other mothers with psychologically disabled kids. She was fighting the Scottish health system for educational services for her child, and she herself had been significantly depressed since her son was first diagnosed with autism. Frustrated with the indifferent and patronizing attitude of mental health professionals who blamed her son's condition on poor parenting, she had researched his condition on the web, had gone to his doctor armed with information about the kind of care he needed. On the IMAC at the counseling center, she made a film about her group's success, which is now being shown to trainees in a local doctoral program. She told me, "At first I was fighting for my own child, but you know, the more you learn, and the further you get into it, you realize it has to be for all children. And when you see that, your life suddenly has a much bigger meaning." When I asked her about her depression, she replied, "Well, once we started the project, I wasn't depressed anymore." And another story, in a shanty town in New Delhi, I encountered a young mental health worker working on a maternal depression project. Not knowing what to do in the face of overwhelming poverty, she first met the women in a non-directed women's group. She asked them, "What do you want to do?" The group decided on a joint action to use the Indian Freedom of Information Act to discover where funds were that were supposed to be for the clean water supply. Through the use of government documents, they located the corruption, got the funds reinstated, and installed their water pipe. Their kids' diarrhea ended, and their mother's depression lifted. And what's more, they had a new water supply in the village. Now they're working on disappearing rice supplies. I submit that these women in Scotland and in New Delhi are living in a new global story that reflects a new level of social maturity, and psychological professionals are part of that. And in that sense, they are acting as cultural architects. Now, I realize that the notion of psychologists making deliberate interventions into mass consciousness is not a neutral issue, and raises, as it should, questions of ethics, hegemony, and cultural imperialism. But in reality, whether we want it or not, psychology is already becoming a global resource, Values, ways of thoughts, modes of relating that are informed by psychology are already part of the hidden curriculum of the information age. So I would argue that rather than recuse ourselves from seeing what we do in cultural terms, we make our roles as cultural healers and facilitators explicit and get much, much better at it. I believe the humanistic psychology story, at least the kind that Carl Rogers gave us, is up to the challenge of facilitating global maturation in a respectful way. I once asked a black South African colleague why he felt the idea that Carl Rogers, a white American psychologist, could give to his people. He replied, quoting Rogers, who was paraphrasing Gertrude Stein about Paris, he said, "It's not what person-centered therapy gives you, it's what it doesn't take away." He explained that in particular it did not take away the right to make meaning in one's own ways, the honoring of the unique experience of each individual, their stories, and the creative power of all of his Soweto neighbors. Humanistic psychology's dialogical stance, grounded in person-to-person encounter, within relationships of mutual respect, where each participant's subjectivity is prized, that trusts the inborn capacity for self-direction, makes humanistic psychology uniquely positioned to be adapted to almost any local realities. It's not any specific therapeutic intervention that distinguishes humanistic approaches, but it's its epistemology and values, which recognizes the socialist construction of human reality, including its own. In its non-pathologizing view, its unquenchable confidence in human capacity and for learning and growth. Humanistic psychology is a critique of the psychological practices of power. Humanistic psychology does not offer answers or offer any formulae for happiness, success. It doesn't offer codes of behavior. It simply trusts that when people, whether individuals or communities, are in touch with their own unique experience, and they have the support of a trusting and trustworthy companions, and when they're willing to engage authentically, which includes both critique and appreciation, they can create their own coherence. They can find their own answers and become increasingly able to thrive in a complex world. I confess I fear that as a profession, psychology has lost its way. And we're fiddling while Rome burns, and most of our graduate schools increasingly focus on turning out more fiddlers rather than putting out the fires or building a more just world. I would like to say here that I don't think that's true of schools like Sacred Graduate School. I think at Sacred Graduate School, we really know what this is about. It's not that our profession fails to attract idealists and people who want to make a difference. Far from it. It's more that the framing assumptions and structures of most of our institutions keep us locked in antiquated modes of thought that make radical or even modest change very difficult. Standards of accreditation and licensing remain grounded in individualistic, mechanistic, biomedical epistemologies that were already obsolete before they became mandatory. We are investing immense resources to get prescription privileges. We fight for turf and reimbursements with social workers and counselors, and we avoid taking clear positions against injustice, war, and torture. We insist that people must have a doctorate to provide clinical services, and our training continues to focus heavily on diagnosing and treating individual pathology, addressing the symptoms but not the causes of today's psychological crisis. We do little to help ordinary citizens understand the psychodynamics of the political manipulation on the one hand, or the transformational social possibilities that are right there on the other hand. The success of Al Gore's movie brought home to ordinary citizens the inconvenient truth about global climate change. I want to ask you to consider that we're dealing with an equally inconvenient truth regarding the crisis that looms in our psychological climate. And we are a long way from identifying, let alone addressing, the scope of the problem. Of the close to a billion people suffering from some form of serious psychological distress, only a fraction, less than 0.1%, gets any professional care at all. Is it reasonable, or is it delusional, to maintain that we can address these astronomic levels of mental stress, let alone the transformational possibilities with professionals whose training takes as long as 6 years post-master's and costs hundreds of thousands of dollars? What the world needs, I maintain, is not more highly trained, high-cost psychological doctors or stronger drugs, but more psychologically literate citizens who have the mental capacities to understand what is happening and to thrive in a world that is different from the one that they expected. We need more emancipatory educators, facilitators, organizers, servant leaders, communicators, filmmakers, video game makers, who understand that the theme of history in which we are participating is about the breakdown in old orders and the possible emergence of a new global consciousness, and who wish to help ensure that this process leads to transformation, not collapse. It almost doesn't matter where you start. These social workers in Scotland and India just started by asking the women what they want, what they thought they needed. Others make work with homeless people, work with the Iraqi refugees. There are a million ways to help this process, from policymaking at the World Health Organization to individual trauma counseling. What matters is framing what we're doing in terms of a larger cultural process underway. Recently, entrepreneur Paul Hawken reported that there are over 200,000 grassroots organizations worldwide involving hundreds of millions of individuals who are dedicated to social justice, environmental conservation, civil society, child welfare, refugees, psychiatric rights, maternal health, unorganized and spread across every nation on earth, and informed by the same emancipatory values. I've also reported on another whole informal psychological profession that is under the APA radar screen in coaching, expressive arts workshops, women's circles, meditation practices, martial arts, parenting classes, AA, and it goes on. These are providing the opportunities for millions of people to develop the new psychological literacies, to do the kind of work we're talking about art, wherever they have a chance to do it. The world does not always appreciate, by the way, being called out on its reluctance to change or on its pathology. But I believe that something very big is happening, that the stakes are very high, and psychologists should be part of it. So I conclude with a quote from Rogers, who said, "If the time comes when our culture tires of endless homicidal feuds, despairs of the use of force and war as a means of bringing peace, becomes discontented with the half-lives which its members are living, only then will our culture seriously look for alternatives. When that time comes, they will not find a void. They will discover that there are ways of facilitating the resolution of feuds. They will find that there are ways of building communities without sacrificing the potential creativity of the person. They will realize that there are ways of enhancing learning, of moving towards new values, of raising consciousness to new levels. They will find that there are ways of being that do not involve power over persons or groups. They will discover that harmonious community can be built on the basis of mutual respect and enhanced personal growth. As humanistic psychologists, we've created working models on a small scale that our culture can use when it's ready." I think if Carl Rogers was with us today, he would be telling us that the culture is ready. He would be asking us to reframe our practice in the light of the larger story of consciousness. He would be urging us to dedicate our profession, our graduate schools, our practices, our research, our activism, our critique, our appreciation in its arenas of action and our lives to aiding the emergence of a humane global consciousness that will enable people wherever they are located to thrive in the new context of complexity. And he would be urging us to trust that no matter how dark it gets, if we will live in the questions and engage with the questions rather than grasp for easy solutions or easy answers, we have the collective capacity to realize the evolutionary potential in the very complexity that we're living in, and to learn our way forward. Thank you.